Hi there. Welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I am reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Carrie Lynn, and we are going to be talking about The Three Body Problem by Cixin Li, and that was the 2015 winner of the Hugo Award. So, Carrie, thanks for joining me. Carrie Lynn, sorry.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, it was cool. Actually, you were one of the early people to reach out to me on social media, and unfortunately, it was to let me know that my feed was down because you wanted to...
Oh, that's right.
I think you wanted to listen to the Hyperion episode or Dune. And
both, yeah.
I had just published it, and there had been an update on in my WordPress, and it had had screwed up the plugin that I use for podcasting. So thank you, by the way, for letting me know about that. And also that anybody was out there and listening, because that was cool. That was encouraging.
Yeah, I just got lucky and saw some posts you'd made on Twitter. And it just so happens that Dan Simmons, who's the author of Hyperion, is my favorite author in science fiction and is actually going to figure fairly greatly in my PhD dissertation.
Nice.
And Dune by Frank Herbert is a old favorite of mine since I was a teenager, and he was the subject of my master's thesis. So you totally hit a home run with those two first episodes. I was like, I have to listen to this.
Excellent. Cool. So where might people know you from?
So I am just getting started in podcasting. I'm a regular guest on the Atlantic SC podcast, which is Jason and Lee. It's Atlantic Screen Connection. Mm-hmm. And they have me on usually when they cover science fiction movies. So we did Alien Covenant recently, and I managed to nab the episode for Blade Runner 2049 coming up in October.
Cool.
Yeah, so you'll see me there once in a while. And I'm also fairly new to the team with the New Books Network, which is a podcast that has multiple channels that interviews scholarly authors of scholarly books, of academic books. And so I'm the host of the Secularism channel.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you tell me about kind of some of your history and background, your geeky history, as I say.
Right. Well, like I've heard a few of your other guests mention, I grew up with science fiction in the home. Mm-hmm. We watched Star Trek. I was a huge fan of Star Wars when I was a very small girl. So for me, it was mostly through TV and movies. And I ended up beginning my master's thesis about 5 years ago in literature. And when I decided what path I wanted to go on, I chose the science fiction route because I'm really interested in how science fiction speaks to culture theory and stuff like that. And I realized as I sort of started working into that, that I actually haven't read a lot of science fiction novels. I read a lot of fantasy when I was younger. I've read really broadly around a lot of historical fiction, a lot of classics. I did a lot of Victorian literature in my undergrad. And I realized, you know what? I'm trying to make this my career. I'm super interested in the theory, but I actually haven't read that many of the classic science fiction novels. So I've been trying to make up for that, partly because when I was younger, I took the literature really seriously as serious predictions of what the future would hold, which of course is not. Yeah, that's not how you're supposed to read science fiction.
Right.
It's supposed to be a reflection on now, a comment on society, which is why it's so great for cultural theory. But as a young reader, I took it to be like literal predictions, and I'd be like, well, this is dumb. You know, this isn't going to happen. And it, right. I don't know. It kind of ruined the suspension of disbelief for me. So now, as a reader, I'm trying to approach things more from that more abstract perspective. Like, what is the author trying to say about their contemporary context? Instead of judging these 1950s and 60s writers as having some really strange ideas about the future, looking at it more like, no, they were dealing with really strange ideas about technology that was new to them at the time.
Right.
So that's really helped me kind of get into these books quite a bit more. So
cool. Well, you definitely bring a more learned kind of perspective on this stuff than I do. I was a technology major, you know, I majored in engineering. And so in the course of kind of taking all those techo classes, I I began to really crave the humanities stuff. And so I really enjoyed when I took like Survey of Art and when I took Masterpieces of World Literature and that kind of stuff. And that kind of helped turn me into more of a reader. Because I had a real doldrums in my, like from high school on up, you know, I didn't want to read anything. I read some Star Trek novels, you know, and maybe like the Timothy Zahn Star Wars ones when those first came out. But yeah, you couldn't get me to read. And it was going to engineering school that kind of got me back wanting something other than just technical stuff. And so it's interesting in a book like this one that has a definite hard science fiction element to it. I can lose patience with hard science fiction if it gets too technical. So it'll be interesting to talk about those parts of this book.
Yeah, I definitely thought the same thing. Like this book is really a revisiting of the old hard science fiction genre. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'm not really widely read in science fiction, like I said, so I don't know if a lot of other people are doing that. I don't know if there's a lot of real interest in that, but he certainly does in a very contemporary way. So I was like, oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad that your tech classes brought you back around to the arts,
because
I'm a firm believer that literature is just the medium for doing higher level thinking.
Sure.
So when people say like, oh, you know, I can't get through the stuffy Dickens or whatever, I can sympathize if that's not your thing. But at the end of the day, people really always connect around stories. Some people call it peak TV. We're at peak TV right now, right? And we've got all this amazing storytelling going on in our culture. And you see how people light up to come together, share ideas about what they're watching. And what really a lot of the time what we're talking about too is human characteristics. Mm-hmm. How, you know, when stories are told in a realistic way, you have real seeming people that are behaving in ways that are psychologically consistent with reality. Mm-hmm. And we can get right into that and talk about what that means, just the same as if they were real people acting that way in the real world. And so I think a lot of people see this big divide between themselves and you know, literature on the ivory tower or whatever. But I don't really think it's like that. I think stories are something we all connect to and make sense out of. So.
Well said.
Thanks. I'm practicing for when I'm a university professor and I have to convince all the tech students in my class. There's a reason why you're here. It's good. Right. It's good.
Yeah. It's the opposite of the when are we going to use this in real life that you get from math and that kind of stuff.
Eggs. Oh, no. Yeah, you're right. There's some of that in math, too. Ha ha. Yeah. Goes both ways.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. You have the art majors asking that question of the math, and then you have the tech majors asking it about literature.
I am a person that likes to straddle the two.
Yeah.
And so I've been told that that's, as a teacher in literature, that'll be kind of good because there's not a lot of humanities people that like to straddle the science versus the humanities, whereas that's clearly totally my bag.
Nice. Well, you mentioned that you realized you hadn't read all that many of them. And so I want to check in on how many Hugo winners you've actually read.
Yes. Yes, I know. This is the test question that I hope I'm not going to fail here, because honestly, this morning when I was reading through the list and counting, I was really worried that it was going to be an embarrassing like 4 or something. So I created a separate list of how many authors I've read on the list, because there's some authors that I've read where the ones that have won the Hugo Award is not the one I've read by them. Mm. But anyways, it turned out to be basically the same. So if I count the retro Hugos, I have read a total of 16 Hugo winners. So
nice.
Not embarrassing. Nothing to brag about, but not embarrassing. So
no. And that's, you know, that's why I'm doing this, right? To increase my number. I'm at 17 right now with this book. This was, I think about half of the episodes so far have been rereads for me, which is fine. I kind of want to revisit all of them. But I totally do count the retro Hugos. Otherwise my number would be smaller.
Yeah.
Let's start talking about kind of the book and what is it about this book? Why did you choose it?
Right. So I think for both of us in this case, this is one where neither of us has read it before.
Right.
Whereas a lot of your guests in the past have come with their favorite book or one of their favorite books in hand. Mm-hmm. So, but I chose this book for a reason, and that's, it partly goes back to this article that I read a few years ago that got me really interested in Chinese science fiction or Asian science fiction generally, because I'd seen a little bit of movies. There's some great South Korean movies, actually. and they just have a really different feel. And like I said, I'm interested in the cultural theory aspects of science fiction. And so I realized that there is a very, very different attitude towards technology in Asian cultures. And that means that how it comes through in their science fiction is very, very different. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of, it's kind of this schizophrenic bifurcation in the Western mindset towards technology. On the one hand, we create some of the best technology in the world. We champion it. We invite it into our lives, our phones, our Uber, our Skype, you know, like, we love it. But on the other hand, there's this ongoing fear of technology. Going back to the Industrial Revolution, where automation in factories was putting people out of jobs. And so, the pace of change alarms people. And so there's a constant theme in Western science fiction where technology comes alive as a monster. Hmm. It's monsterized. It kills people. There's also a sub theme going on there where technology is not only personified, but it's a woman. And it's a dangerous, threatening woman who probably has layers of sexual attraction, but she's the succubus, right? Like she'll kill you. And so this is actually one of the themes that I got into my master's, and it's really, really interesting stuff. And there's tons of it. There really isn't, I don't think there's the same thing in Asian science fiction, because you don't have the same kind of long relationship of a fear of technology going along in there. It's quite a bit more, just embracing technology as a positive tool in life. And we kind of see that in this book too. Technology is not the villain. So, right. So to get back to that article that got me first interested in Asian science fiction, I was rereading it for this week for this show and realized that it's written by Ken Lee. Is it pronounced Liu? Lee?
Yeah, but- Liu or Lu, I'm not sure.
Okay, so the man who translated our book here into English, he actually wrote this fantastic article for Gizmodo called "The Heroic Translators Who Reinvented Classic Science Fiction in China," and he gives kind of this background to how science fiction came to the Asian countries in the 20th century, which was super interesting. So I just want to share a little bit of that because I think it'll give some good background to this book. He's talking about the translation process in general. Anybody who works in translation today will tell you that translators work very hard to convey the sense of the work without taking too many liberties in terms of interpretation. So a straight up direct translation like you get with Google Translate obviously usually is not going to do the trick, right?
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of cultural gaps that need to be bridged, and those are judgment calls made by well-trained, good translators. So that's like our contemporary conception of what translation's all about. And he's saying, you know, if you look at the original translators of classical Western science fiction, back when it first got translated, it was first into Japanese, it was really, really different. They took really audacious, bold steps in their translation because so many of the concepts were utterly foreign to their culture that the authors had to fabricate all kinds of extra passages to the books to give a sense of what was going on that otherwise their readers just wouldn't know. So, so he explains that, China had a humiliating defeat, I guess, in the Sino-Japanese War in 1895.
Yeah.
Leading Chinese intellectuals believed that China's culture suffered from backwardness, that's his word, that could only be improved with a massive infusion of Western ideas and thoughts in the form of translated literature. So what they were thinking of in particular was technology, basically, and the kind of attitude that embraced science and technology. And here's where the kernel of that enthusiasm, just an unbridled enthusiasm and confidence in science and technology kind of starts for them. And I thought it was really interesting that they saw stories and literature as being one of the ways to communicate that to their average people. They wanted that to be on every level of class. The Chinese saw that the Japanese had done it a generation earlier with what appeared to be success. So they wanted to adopt that as well. And they just took the Japanese translations and translated those into Chinese. So we've got like a couple of steps away from the originals. And these Chinese intellectuals thought science fiction was the best, in particular because it would introduce their people to scientific thinking, to a population that was otherwise mired in a kind of primitive superstition and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So one early translator of a Jules Verne novel enthusiastically explains in his introduction how, unlike actual science, which will probably bore the average reader, he asserts, science fiction is a powerful tool to infuse its reader with scientific wisdom, breaking down legacy superstitions, improving thinking, and supplementing their culture. So they really had a high opinion of what this could do and how the whole scientific mindset was a thing that they wanted. So the original Japanese translators often took big liberties in making their adaptations because of the massive linguistic and cultural gaps. And they also didn't even have the vocabulary. So he says that as a result, many of the earliest translated works are so different from the source text that they can scarcely be called translations. So I just found that incredibly interesting. And because I am interested in the cultural aspects of works, I thought it would be really awesome to do a cultural comparison of Chinese science fiction with Western science fiction. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my thesis advisor said, you don't speak fluent Chinese.
Right.
So at a PhD level, you really can't just work from translations. So probably a no-go. Right. So I had to relegate it to just like hobby academic interests. So it was really great to be able to like pull it out of the back drawer there, dust it off, and think about it for this episode. So.
Cool. Happy to help. Well, that was really cool. I had been looking around for articles, you know, to drop into the show notes. So I hope you'll send me that so that I can drop it in
there. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, if anybody ever wants to contact me on Twitter or whatever to share sources, I'm always happy to do that. So
nice. So let's kind of get into our formal non-spoiler discussion of the book. So this is the part of the podcast where if you haven't read the book and you're still on the fence, we're going to try to convince you to read it.
Right.
Or give you an idea if this is something that you want to read.
Right.
So do you have, you know, like a very short pitch for this book?
Well, I think what I would say is that it deals with the scenario of first contact. So it's one of those kinds of science fiction novels. As we mentioned kind of before, it's a new take on the old genre of the hard science fiction. Mm-hmm. Not about gadgets or rocket ships in this case, but certainly engineering concepts, astrophysics, as well as some other physics concepts. Sometimes it gets quite granular into the details of how certain things work. But it's not so much that it bogs you down. If you're an engineer and you really enjoy that stuff, you'll probably love it. Mm-hmm. If you're not, it's okay. It's not gonna dissuade you too much. I would also say that because it's set in China and it starts with the Chinese Cultural Revolution, people that are interested in Chinese history or the role of mathematics in Chinese culture, anybody interested in those kind of topics is going to enjoy this book.
Yeah, definitely. And I liked a lot of the hard science fiction elements were almost brought up in a history of science way because they had representations of different characters, you know, scientists through history that were expounding these concepts. And that was cool to me because history of science is one of my kind of hobbies.
That's a good point. And that speaks to that early translator too, saying that the best way to teach is through stories, right? Because if you just read the dry history or you read the dry information, it's boring.
Yeah, and that might be something that we can actually talk about here in the non-spoiler section. Let's keep the discussion of Three Body into the spoiler section.
So I had wanted to talk about the history of mathematics in Chinese history as well. Did we want to talk about that at this point, or did you want to save it for when we can talk about it in more detail?
Yeah, let's save that.
Okay.
So just kind of overall thoughts. What was your impression of this book?
Well, I think I got what I was asking for because I wanted a different cultural experience. And I have to admit that there were elements of the book that struck me as odd. And so we'll get into more detail in the spoiler section. But Yeah, I could really tell, for me anyways, I felt like I was reading something that was coming from a different assumptions culturally, with the way that people interacted with each other, and some of the other underlying assumptions about what was important and how people would emotionally respond to certain things. I was just like, really? Okay, so you got that too?
I did, yeah. And, you know, I often will look to science fiction to show me something interesting about science that I hadn't thought about. And this one delivers on that, but then it also has that additional cultural part where it just kind of talks about how science is approached in a different culture.
Yeah.
And especially early on with the Cultural Revolution stuff. And I want to get back to that. I don't want to go into spoilers on that necessarily right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely, even there were a couple spots kind of in the way the dialogue was translated that struck me as, this is not native English speakers speaking English. And I found that it's deliberate, actually, where Ken Liu didn't want to translate it so that it sounded like it was written by a Westerner. It still needed to sound different in some way. And I couldn't put my finger on it. And it reminded me of watching like a Chinese language film and reading the subtitles, where they're not always typical English vernacular, or even a dubbed film. You know, sometimes you're like, well, okay, that was sounded interesting. But it's because of that translation element where it wants to reproduce the way the speech is happening without making it confusing for a listener in another language or a reader in another language. And as I got into it, I really admired that it maintained the feel of something written in another language without it being off-putting in any way.
I agree. I think that's definitely a triumph for the translator, because he manages to retain that strange feel while it's still, like you say, it doesn't trip you up while you're reading or anything like that. Some of the characters, the way they interacted too, I felt like I was picturing in my mind some kind of Asian dubbed movie or something, where the characters kind of interacted with each other in caricatured kinds of ways that I could picture playing out in an Asian movie that just strike the Western eye as being a little odd.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, and that comes down to characterization, and the characterization was a little bit odd in this book. And again, I mean, when you look at hard science fiction, that's one of the things people will complain about it, is that there is no characterization in hard science fiction. So I thought, well, maybe there's an intentional imitation of the earlier genre then. And that's kind of a cool thing to do. Or maybe it's a Chinese thing. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's just this author. I'm really not sure. Mm-hmm. So it was just, it was a different experience.
Yeah, there's definitely a different dramatic sensibility to it.
That's it.
And like when you watch foreign films, I work with a lot of Indian coworkers, and one of them was telling me about a recent film that's just this blockbuster called Bahubali, I think. And I've been meaning to watch it, and I started watching part of it, and the drama in it is so dramatic, so over the top for me that to me, I'm like, okay, I got to put myself in the right frame of mind. But she's like, no, it's very operatic. You know, it's it's got that melodrama to it that's their language in film.
Right.
And this book, I felt like in a couple spots kind of had that slightly different dramatic sensibility.
So. Yeah, especially with a police officer, not to get too specific, but he stood out to me as being like this caricature from some strange movie or some strange play or something, where it's just like, what, really? And he was so unlike any of the other characters, who were all much, much more flat. Mm-hmm. So, I don't have the background to totally understand what was going on there, but...
Yeah, no, me neither. So in terms of kind of, I didn't give my thoughts on it. Also, I did really enjoy it. It was something that I wanted to keep reading. I'm not a super fast reader. And so I read this in under a week. And there was never a question that, I'm not going to finish this. I mean, obviously I was doing it for the podcast and I wasn't going to let you down. but it never crossed my mind that, this is a slog. I can't handle this. It was very good. So.
It wasn't like that for me. I got frustrated at points, although I do that sometimes when I'm reading anyways. Like I want to engage in a dialogue with the author or something. I'll start to get frustrated with a strategy that they take. So I got some of that in the third act there. But I realized by the time I finished it, like I feel like reading the others now because I want to find out, like, did he resolve this question that he kind of left hanging, or what does happen when that happens? So, yeah. So I guess that says something. I want to read the others.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of recommending this book to someone, on what basis would you recommend it? You know, based on their like of what genre or other or film or other books. Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it to people who are engineers who really enjoy thinking through mathematical problems. It actually made me remember Interstellar, the movie Interstellar, because it was a narrative that grew around astrophysics concepts.
Right.
And so in a lot of ways, I feel like this book is the same thing. Somebody took some astrophysics concepts and said, let's make a story about this, and did. So for people that are really into that kind of strategy for narrative, I think they would like that.
Yeah. I would also say this has some nonlinear elements to it. So if you like that kind of presentation of material, so like Christopher Nolan's, you know, a couple of his films like The Prestige and Batman Begins tell things out of order in some ways. And this definitely has that, where they're going back and talking about, here's what happened earlier.
That's funny, because I didn't even think about that. You're right, it does. That wouldn't bar me from reading a book.
Yeah. So in terms of like a specific title that I think if you liked this book, you might enjoy this one. They're very different books, but Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke is another First Contact story. And it's all about the implications of what happens to humanity based on this contact. And in the three-body problem, you kind of have two sides of that, right? Where you have the first contact on both sides, and you're talking about what the difference is, what it's making for both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So
the other thing that occurred to me is Ken Lee or Ken Liu, in the end of his article that I was talking about there, talks a little bit about how he takes on translation challenges in his own work, the idea of translating culture. And so he talks about his debut novel of his own that's not translated. He just wrote it in English. His first novel is called The Grace of Kings. Mm-hmm. And he comes up with this silk punk epic fantasy is what he calls it. And he reimagines the history and legends surrounding the rise of the Han Dynasty. And then he puts it in a fantasy kind of landscape. And the silk punk aspect has to do with the fact that it's drawing on typical Asian imagery. So bamboo and silk and kimonos and this kind of aesthetic. Mm-hmm. So for anybody who, like me, is really interested in just getting a different cultural experience, if you're coming at it strictly from that perspective, then I want to try Ken Liu's Grace of Kings is what it's called. So, yeah.
It definitely does make me want to read him. Kind of understanding the accomplishment that he had here in translating this.
Yeah.
So I think it's about time for spoilers.
Okay.
Don't you? We're both recommending this one, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So, dear listener, if you're out there, don't be spoiled unnecessarily. Okay. So, free-form discussion here. Anything you want to talk about? Anything you want to bring up?
Yeah. Well, I found another really excellent article, so I might just start with that, because, again, it just adds to the background and understanding this novel better. And so I want to give credit to Alan J. Levinovitz. I found his article on aeonmagazine.com, or it's aeon.com, but it's Aeon Magazine. And so his article is called The New Astrology: By Fetishizing Mathematical Models, Economists Turned Economics into a Highly Paid Pseudoscience. So like it sounds like his article is about modern economists, but he talks a lot about the role of mathematics in ancient China to create his comparison. And so that's the part that I really found fascinating, because I, like I mentioned before, I don't know a lot about Chinese culture and history. And when I read this, I realized this book is most certainly inspired by some real historical events in China's ancient past. And the author is just kind of taking a creative license with them to create a science fiction premise out of them. So So that is basically, it has to do with astrology. The Chinese have believed very strongly in astrology in their history. So they believed that the movements of the heavenly bodies had a divine influence on human events, if you don't know what astrology is. Great. So, yeah. So the mathematical study of the stars was immensely important because they thought that if you could predict the movement of the stars, you could foretell the future. Complex mathematics was understood as a divine language, even, and they also thought that if you did it right, you could create paradise on Earth. Utopia was at the end of a formula, in other words.
Huh.
So the government spent a ton of money on it. And so there's scenes in the book where they, where our main character Wang goes into this mysterious video game world, which for me was the most compelling and the best parts of the book because it was very eerie and very beautiful and very grand about the way that he constructed these video game worlds. Mm-hmm. And so it turns out, I think these scenes were, well, you're given the clue that they're inspired by history because there's historical characters, like you mentioned, both from right. Chinese history, and then much later they get into some Western philosophers and mathematicians. But it starts with King Zhu, Z-H-O-U, and he kind of is the original he's a historical king, but he kind of became a legend as well because he was at the beginning of this movement to hold mathematical competitions, in essence, to understand the movement of the stars better, and the beginning of this kind of astrology. And so, and I might be getting elements of that wrong, and I'm sorry, but if I am, somebody can correct me. But he is kind of central to the mystical astrology history in some way there. And so we see this played out in the video game. So to go back to the actual history, They created armillary spheres. They invented armillary spheres. Those are the ones with the spherical center. And then you have all of these rings that are around it and they're on a hinge and you can move them around.
Sure.
And they represent the heavenly bodies and whatnot. So those were invented at the time. And they actually took tons and tons of bronze cash and melted them down to make this thing. So the historian that's cited in the article here, he says that symbolically this armillary sphere was considered like a divine mathematical world engine built of cash and legitimizing the powers that be. So you can kind of see the role that it has, the significance and the importance that it has. Of course, then all of this work and expense was totally unsuccessful. They attempted to hold rituals on auspicious days, and yet they still had floods and drought and disaster. And there were even governmental efforts to scientifically micromanage agriculture using astrology. And of course, those ended in famine and mass migration. So in the 3rd century AD, China was seeking a new model. And so they held a grand contest. And there was Han Yi, the assistant director of the astronomical office, had his model, and then there was a competing model. They conducted this competition for 3 years, where they gathered data that they referenced, made comparisons and exchanges. But after 3 years, nobody could agree which model was even better or how they should be tested. So the historian explains that in the end, a live trial involving the prediction of eclipses and helical risings was used to settle the debate. But of course, he points out how flawed that is because helical risings, which is the first visibility of planets, depends on non-mathematical factors like eyesight, atmospheric conditions.
Sure.
And then they scored the trial by modeling it after archery competitions. So these great mathematical ideals comes down to kind of these primitive means of the end. And of course, he says, though, that unlike in our novel, where they're dealing with a much more complex mathematical scenario with the three heavenly bodies that's the three body problem. Of course, is you've got these astral bodies that are in an orbit around the three of them. So that has come to chaotic math or theories of chaos theory. chaos theory. Thank you. Whereas the math they were doing in Chinese history was a lot more simple. And so they were able to accurately predict the heavenly patterns. They just, you know, obviously astrology doesn't work. So it wasn't influencing anything. So this is clearly a historical precedent that this novel is just picking up on and putting it in a new galaxy, making it more complex. But the history of this planet shares Chinese history in a sense. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's fascinating the way the book uses the three body sections. And you said that they were your favorite parts. And at the beginning, I didn't totally get them. And
yeah,
I was a little impatient with them. And then once I figured out what was actually going on there, then I wanted to get back to one of those because I wanted to see how they would progress. Because it's not right away that you find out that the whole wanting to come up with the mathematical model for modeling the three-body problem, that it was actually something practical, that it was actually because of the situation for the Trisolarns.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I like that when there's a mystery in there too, right? When you have to put the pieces together and figure out why is this significant. That's part of the reason I think I enjoyed those parts.
Yeah. Well, and it was fun too because there were figures like Newton and Leibniz and
Da Vinci.
Copernicus and Da Vinci, who kind of all made appearances. And it was fascinating to see as somebody who works in computing, when they tried to make essentially an analog computer using just the massive army of the king.
That was fantastic. Yeah. Yeah,
that was terrific.
Yeah, what an image. Yeah, what did they use? Like 300,000 soldiers standing in a massive square, which was their motherboard. And then they had the binary flags, white and black flags that represented the binary states of ones or zeros.
Yeah.
And they were apparently able to, be like a human computer. And I actually saw online, have you seen any of the debates about whether or not that would be plausible, even at a super slow speed?
No, I haven't. Conceptually, it was interesting, though, just watching them, because coming from a background in computer science and engineering and that kind of stuff, you know, I knew exactly what they were doing when he had the two guys with the two flags and then the one guy who was watching them and deciding which flag to put up. You know, he's creating logic gates.
Right. And then there's even a bus.
Right.
It was amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
I saw one person even go as far, I can't remember where I saw this comment, but I think it might have been on Goodreads, actually. One person made the comment that the Trisolarans communicate with light. So in the game, it was flags, but for the actual aliens, it would have been with light. And so he was saying that it would have been very possible because that was kind of a debate going on in the thread. But fascinating to think about from a person who doesn't have a computer background to think of it in those very mechanical terms is very cool.
Yeah. Well, and it's nice to hear, though, because that was in my comfort zone, right? When it doesn't sound like it necessarily was in yours, but it sounds like it was skillfully enough done that it still worked for you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And I mentioned that, lots of times in a hard science fiction book, I'll enjoy the first read through. I'll enjoy all the technical detail. And then when I come back to it and reread it, then I'll be like, okay, no, we don't need all this stuff. And so like reading something like Jurassic Park, you know, it's got a lot of lengthy passages in it, or even like The Martian, on a reread, you know, all that stuff didn't necessarily appeal to me. But this one I think would hold up, though, because of the way it's presented in the game.
Yeah. I mean, there were some parts, not many, though, some short parts where I did start to skim, you know, where I realized I don't need to know all this to be able to follow the story. And I just kind of just skimmed through a paragraph here or there. But I didn't have to do that a whole lot. And really, the human computer was not one of those sections. That was just really interesting. So,
yeah. So I want to go back to the beginning of the novel because it begins very, very differently.
Right.
Talking about the Cultural Revolution and its effect on science. And that's very relevant today, given that you have governments that tend to be anti-science. My government, unfortunately, is trending that direction.
Yeah, has been trending that direction for a little while, I'm afraid.
It has, yeah. And you know, as a Christian man who's in lots of times very conservative circles, you know, I can definitely see that from friends and family, just kind of that rejection of science as if somehow it's
not going to be true because they don't believe in it.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what Neil deGrasse Tyson says. The nice thing about science is it's true even if you don't believe it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I thought it was fascinating when, what was his name? Yi Jetai, I think. That was Yi Wenji's father.
Who was executed in the beginning.
Where they were taking him to task for teaching relativity and teaching the Big Bang and just the idea that your ideology can make some science objectionable is a concept that I just don't accept. You can't do that. What are we going to base it on if not science?
Well, this is something that came up a little later too, when Yi, the daughter, was talking about how she tried to train her own daughter in science. And then when she gets the Silent Spring book, and they take that away from her, there's this ongoing idea that certain abstract concepts, things that we would see as being very neutral, mathematical scientific concepts, could be psychologically disturbing because they're quote-unquote revolutionary. So here we get into the communist politics of the day, this feeling that you have to submit to the authoritarian rule, and any ideas that might spark anything critical thinking in your own mind are not only dangerous to the powers that be, but psychologically disturbing to the individual, which this is one of the things that stood out to me as being one of those cultural things that just was odd. Like Yi talks about trying to train. She says, I made a mistake with my daughter. I exposed her to revolutionary ideas or abstract ideas when she was too young. And I just thought, oh, how strange. You know, like I just reject that idea that people would be corrupted or disturbed by a scientific mathematical concept. Like, come on.
Yep.
But that's in that that political context of dealing with authoritarianism. And I thought that was going to be the overarching theme when the book began, this tension between chaos and authoritarianism. It was kind of set up as being a binary choice. You either embrace authoritarian rule and you have stability, or you reject that and you've got total chaos and disaster and psychological trauma. And and so because it starts in the Cultural Revolution too, I was like, okay, this is going to be a really interesting, we've got science versus, and science is kind of allied with the Western idea as well, right? This revolutionary Western ideas versus traditional authoritarianism. And then even in the video game, there's elements, there's symbols of chaos versus order. The order is safe. The chaos, I think they even call it the chaotic period versus the stable period. I mean, huge symbols that this is the theme here. And then it kind of disappeared in the second act. And there's some conflicts, like some self-contradictory elements in the book as well with the way that those two binaries are addressed. And then doesn't really get resolved. Did you find that?
I don't think that really stuck out to me. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think, and this may be addressed in the final novels too. This kind of question that whether or not authoritarian rule is good. So in the beginning, it's set up really obviously that authoritarian rule leads to horrible tragedies, like her father getting killed, and her father is killed, and it clearly for no good purpose. The Cultural Revolution is no good for nobody. The girls that killed her father, they are throwaways of society afterward. It's pretty unambiguous that attempted authoritarian stability is a failure. But by the time you get to the end and you realize what's going on with the Earth Trisolarian organization, what they are striving to achieve, they're divided into two factions, right? You've got the group that wants the aliens' help to kill all of humanity, or you've got the group that wants the aliens' help to bring a new authoritarian rule to Earth. And that's just kind of left there. Like the good guys are the ones that want new authoritarians.
Right. I think that the one slight counterpoint there is when you do get that shift in perspective to the Trisolarans and the listener, you know, he's kind of a melancholy character. And But he expresses that, you know, are we sure, though? I mean, our whole society is built on survival. Because yes. of the nature of them being the last planet in their system, they know eventually they're getting consumed by their star system. And so everything else has been sublimated in service of survival. And so there's no arts. It's very authoritarian.
Right.
And so, you know, free thought really is not permitted in a lot of ways. And even like their justice system, right? You're guilty or not guilty. And if you're guilty, you're executed.
That's right.
For whatever
that's
the right. crime is. And so you do kind of also have that side of there. This authoritarianism in the Trisolarians is also not good. And so I think it kind of is a, you know, you may get what you wish for, but it might not be the thing you want on the part of the Earth Trisolarian organization, right? They want some kind of positive outcome overall. Both of them do, right? Some of them are like, humanity is too corrupt, it needs to be destroyed. That is a positive outcome for them. But the others that want them to come and fix things, I'm not sure the book presents that the Trisolarians are the people to come and fix anything. Because just coming to a paradise like Earth, are they going to be able to fall back into earlier ways of not just surviving?
Well, and that's even alluded to in the book, this problem of people assuming that the Trisolarians are going to be godlike or right. just wonderful people. And the author in his note at the end even makes a comment that he feels that this is a problem that people have with romanticizing the alien, basically. And so he kind of wants to raise that as an issue. So that's why I say maybe this does get resolved in further novels, but at the moment I just felt like there wasn't a clear, there was a an inherent confusion towards whether or not authoritarian had any use at all. So,
He did talk about, you know, the kind of religious fervor that's definitely there on the human side, right? They're almost seeing the Trisolarians as a messianic thing, even calling it, you know, our Lord or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, but from the other side, right, there are people who are going to, on the Trisolarian side, that are going to romanticize Earth and see that as their salvation.
That's right. And they do. Yeah. Right. So it goes both ways. So that's a good representation there.
Yeah. One of the other, and we're kind of getting into themes and other stuff with this, so, you know, you can jump in with anything, but the idea of undermining science was a fascinating thing, especially with the political climate, you know, where there are fields of study that are less acceptable than other fields of study, and so then that the Trisolarians are going to defeat humanity essentially by not letting them develop, by
that's
creating
right.
chaos in their science, right?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
facilitating magical thinking, creating miracles, right? Like the numbers, the countdown that was earlier in the book. And that was something for me that I thought, oh, okay, that's how they did that.
Yes. Yeah. I realized that comes back to tie up that loose thread, like way, way later. I was like, okay, yeah.
And that's that non-linear thing that I was talking about earlier.
Right.
Where things pay off a lot, you know, down the line.
Yeah, so definitely.
There was some pretty wild, and I'm guessing pretty speculative science about the higher dimensions, what protons would be like in higher dimensions.
That was very cool.
That was really cool, but I have no idea to what extent that's grounded in real science,
because I don't
have that kind of theoretical physics background.
Yeah, no, I have to admit, just like with Interstellar, like that was beyond my, it's because it sounds like so much nonsense, but then there's some real things in string theory and particle physics that also really sounds like nonsense, but apparently isn't. So,
right.
But it certainly made for good science fiction. The unfolding of the proton.
Yeah.
That was fantastic. So another debate that I saw on Goodreads there was about Yi, who is the one of the main characters. She's one of the only women characters, which I'd like to kind of come back to that idea too
in
a little bit. But she's also a remorseless murderer, and yet she's treated like a positive protagonist, and like her murders are really justified in this context of this much bigger battle between, you know, the survival of humanity or whatever. But it didn't totally work for me because because I did find that, well, I'll go back to the author's note. Liu says that the wonder of science fiction is, I'm quoting here, that it can, when given certain hypothetical world settings, turn what in our reality is evil and dark into what is righteous and bright, and vice versa. This book and its two sequels try to do just that. So I think in theory, he's right. And this is part of the reason why I really enjoyed the first four or five seasons of The Walking Dead, is because you take a context that is so changed from ours that it's possible to say, well, in my context, this would be an evil action. But actually, for this character in this particular scenario, that becomes a good action. And that is a really interesting thing to explore in fiction. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel that this book succeeded there at all, because the context wasn't changed. The only thing that was changed was that we have a new weapon, the aliens. We have a new ally that could make it that much easier for us to obliterate humanity. Mm-hmm. But the whole moral question of is it okay to kill all of humanity? Should we? Is it okay to kill your husband? Should you? None of that was changed. That was all pretty much exactly the same. Context, and she goes and does it, and she's very emotionless about it. And also this idea that, you know, as their society expands, grows like wildfire throughout the world among those who know about it, this idea that there's so many people who are so excited to see humanity just toasted. Yeah. And I just don't find that, even when I'm trying to suspend my disbelief for fiction here, no, I don't think so.
I guess I would say I bought it for, in terms of her character motivations, because of what happened to her father with the Cultural Revolution, the way she was treated.
This is the thing. It's personal revenge. Personal revenge is not a good reason to kill
all of humanity.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I know. Yeah,
maybe one individual person, you can kind of go, okay, I get
even
that.
Even that's problematic, but you're right. It's much easier to make an argument for that than all of humanity.
Yeah, that's a good point. and you had wanted to talk about some of the, and this goes back to just the characterization in general of a hard science fiction book.
Right.
And talking about the female characters.
Yeah. So the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Which you're probably familiar with.
Two female characters that talk to each other about something other than a man.
Right? Two or more female characters with names. So,
with names. There
yeah.
We go.
An even higher bar to mm-hmm. pass there.
You'd think it should be pretty easy, right?
It's surprisingly not. So anyways, when I was reviewing my notes, I realized it doesn't strictly fail, because there's that scene where Yi goes and tracks down the three girls that murder her father.
Right.
I don't know if they have names or not. It doesn't really matter whether it's
ultimately they're still talking about her father, though.
Oh, they're talking about a man. You're right.
Yeah. When you mentioned that over email about the Bechdel test, I think there's an earlier scene where she's being interrogated by a female guard. Yeah, but I believe she had a name as well.
It's a gray area, because it's pretty easy to make that argument that the guard woman in that one scene had a name, but that doesn't really, that's not the point of the test. But regardless, whether it technically does or not, I found that the depiction of women was really sad. So another term that I came across recently was the Smurfette syndrome. And this is when you have one woman that's totally surrounded by men. So yes, you've got a woman character, and maybe she's a fairly important character, but she's in a man's world, and she's just utterly alone. And so we've got two impressive female scientists with names in this novel, but they are both Smurfettes, certainly. Yeah. So there's that, and there's this really sad scene. I'll go back to when Yi is talking about how she feels like she failed in bringing up her daughter, and she explains to Wang that women are basically too emotionally delicate to be theoretical physicists, period.
Right, like, which just, is total BS.
Oh my God, yeah. She's just like, it's not a woman's field. Women should be like water and adapt, and, you know, it's just not for women. And I told her about some of these ideas, and she just couldn't handle it because she's a girl. And I was just like, facepalm? She is like this unrivaled female scientist. She is the, in a lot of ways, the main character of the story. She persists through her intelligence and her strength. But oh no. That, I guess she's just a fluke and an outlier, because you know women. So that was disappointing. But then there's also there's the marriages. There's only three marriages, I think, that are alluded to. And don't get me wrong, I'm not interested in romance, so my issue was not with that. But it was just really weird. Like, Wang has a wife that he has to deal with on a couple of occasions. She doesn't have any dialogue. She's right. just like an annoyance. She's like, because he can't, he's got the weight of the universe on his shoulders. Like, he is dealing with seeing these numbers come up on his vision. He's dealing right. with the, you know, the extermination of the planet, and he's dealing with all this stuff. And his wife's like, and she, like I say, she doesn't have dialogue. So it's just implied that she's like, what's the matter? Why can't you sleep? And he's like, it's nothing. It's all good. Go back to bed.
Yeah.
And there's one other scene where she appears just to tell him he has a phone message from work. And he spends a lot of time throughout the book staying out on all-night benders. He does a lot of binge drinking and comes in at weird hours, plays video games all night, and she's just not there at all.
Right.
And so it's more like, I just thought the absence was weird. Like, why not make him single? What's the big deal? Why why have a wife that's so a non-character that he doesn't even need to tell her about the end of the world?
Yeah.
And then there's this other marriage with the two scientists where it's a marriage of convenience. And then there's the fact that Yi marries the guy, Yang, I think, in the Red Base Station. And it's just a marriage of convenience. And she ends up, she doesn't want to kill him, but she ends up having to because that's the way it works out. And she just doesn't care. And there's it's alluded to a little bit, this notion that, and this again is a really old fashioned, out of date notion that, scientists are less emotional. And so I wondered if it was kind of, if that was tied up in some of these really old stereotype, ideas about people's personalities, like women are need to be like water and adaptable, and scientists are incapable of emotion because it's what their vocation requires of them, which, believe it or not, people really thought at the beginning of the 20th century. There was a real concern that pursuing science as a career was going to potentially have negative psychological effects because it required you to be emotionless, which sounds so retarded now, but that was taken seriously 100 years ago.
And so, I blame Original Trek for that because of Spock.
Spock? It predates Spock. It totally does.
Yeah, I know. And I loved Spock.
And then you look at Data. Data's the update, right? Data's the robot that wants to be the human. Yeah. So we've come a little way in Star Trek. But yeah, you're right. That's kind of the idea. So I wasn't sure if the scientist relationship had to do with that. But yeah, and that's pretty much it for the women. That's all the women. And it was just weird.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I'm kind of two minds about it because Yi Wenji is a very important character to the book. And she has something of an arc. I mean, she is kind of emotionless, and when her husband dies, it's because she's trying to murder someone else, and she has to make a decision.
So give her a break, right?
Yeah. She tries to let him off the hook, and he literally gets on the hook.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. She does try.
But, I mean, she does kind of, at the end, when she goes back and visits the ruins of the site, I feel like there is a remorse there. That's expressed, but it's not real deep.
Oh, yeah.
Where I think she's kind of rethinking all of her decisions and seeing that, well, maybe bringing the Trisolarians here is not a great idea. Because if anyone is responsible for them coming, it is her.
Yes.
Because of the experiments that she did with the solar amplifier thing, which I have no idea, again, if that's...
Hey, I looked it up. That is a real thing. Einstein wrote a paper back in the 30s. It's called Gravitational Lensing. So it's when...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's when a big gravitational mass, like the sun, it bends approaching light, but also radio waves, and magnifies them. So the limitation...
It does magnify them, okay.
Yeah, and the limitation is that it has to be... It can only do it in a straight line. But it, and I don't think it's nearly to the degree that like the story kind of amps it up a little bit, but it is a real thing.
Fascinating. So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, the book is not perfect, but it's definitely thought provoking and you'd think, and this may be a thing about the culture, right? You don't get a lot of perspective from outside of Chinese culture, even when you have an American character.
That's
true. He is kind of disillusioned by his culture. And coming and trying to make a difference in China, planting trees, right?
Yes.
And he ends up being kind of the founder of the Earth Trisolaran organization along with Yuan Ji.
I thought that was interesting because he was, he was very interested in protecting nature, protecting animals. And so that was his angle for why he was so quick to jump on board with the idea of obliterating humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you don't get a lot of perspectives from other nations, except kind of toward the very end when they're trying to figure out what can we do, because we know they're coming. It's going to be almost 500 years, but they are coming.
Right.
And you finally do get some, you know, generals from, you know, all men, of course, from around the world there.
Did you pick up on the classism towards the end?
Where they didn't want to respect the police?
No, it had to do with when it was talking about the spread of the Earth Trisolarian organization and kind of the thinking of the leaders of the ETO. And it got into some classism that just made me cringe big time. So it explains that the world's, quote, intellectual elites, due to their exposure to modern science and philosophy, were able to see the larger perspective about the need to cleanse humanity. Whereas the common people were working on an animalistic instinct, and so therefore they had too limited a view to realize that all of humanity needed to be killed. This is weird,
right?
Okay?
Then,
So, and not only that, like, it's not self-reflexive. It's not really like, oh, that's part of why these people are evil. It was just like, well, no, we know that people that have more education are going to get it. And you know, the unwashed masses there, they don't get anything. And which you don't see a lot of anymore. And just kind of in this bare way. And then, so the book says that the elites were dubbed by others, it doesn't elaborate on who, spiritual nobles.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just kind of like it's just kind of assumed that everybody accepts that those are the spiritual nobles. Those are the intellectual elites. And the intellectual elites also assume that the aliens, and now this is the part where it's self-reflexive on and says they're making a mistake, but they assume that the aliens will also love them best because they will also be classist, which I thought was interesting. So the elites tended to be wealthy and powerful, naturally. And so I just thought it was really odd that the people that had the most luxury in life, the most opportunities, I mean, when you put it into the context right now of this hatred of the 1% and, you know, wealth disparity and all like that, you know, and this book is suggesting that it's the people with the most luxurious lives, the most power, the most way to live the way you want to live. These are the ones that want to kill everybody. And it's the bottom 10% that are the ones that are so connected to the earth that they feel very strongly about survival. And I just thought, they're not the ones that harbor all of this bitterness and anger. I just thought that was really a reversal of what would make sense. And then the fact that Yi is motivated by her hard times and her desire for revenge is kind of contradicting that whole notion. Yi didn't grow up with all the luxuries. She comes from that in her family, I guess you could argue further past, but she's embittered by her experience and that's why she wants to kill everybody. So I was just like, what? Yeah. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's there. It is literally there. Page 317 and 318.
Yeah, that's right at the end.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So anything else? I'm about out of notes, I have to admit.
No, I'm out of notes as well.
Okay. Definitely some passion here. And I mean, this is a book that I think we both enjoyed, but there are definitely some issues, and some of them, it's hard to know if you're putting it down to, this is just something that's ingrained in Chinese culture, perhaps. There may be some elitism built in there.
Yeah, this is a thing.
Or if it's just the author.
I don't know enough to, I don't want to paint all of China with a Chishin Lee brush, right? Like, I don't know.
Right.
But, and don't get my passion wrong. Like, I do this, I hope, for a living in class and in essays and articles and whatnot, because I get fired up by literature. I'm not literally getting angry at the author, or I wouldn't call him out for being a classist or anything else. These are just the ideas that the novel raises, right? And so for me, I get really into like chewing right into them. But for me, the book that's terrible is the one that has nothing to talk about. Whereas
absolutely,
the book, right. Whereas the book that's good has these things that you can dig your teeth into, and even when the paths kind of dwindle off and don't go where you want them to go or don't explain themselves, there's still stuff there. So, yeah. So yep. it was an engaging and enjoyable read. So,
yeah, definitely, and something different. Which is nice.
Yeah, which is what I was looking for. So.
Of course, if really what you want from your science fiction is a lot of misogyny and classism, you can go back and read stuff from the 50s and find plenty of that.
So. There's lots. Yeah. We're revisiting the past in a way by revisiting the future.
And that'll be fun because eventually I'll have to get to all those titles.
That's right. I think this is such a great idea. I applaud you. I wanted to do it as well. And I keep listening to your episodes because... sometimes when I have an idea, and I listen to the spoilers, but sometimes when I have an idea of where the book is going, that stokes the interest for me to read the details. Gotcha. So I'm listening and enjoying it all. And it's actually like, I want to do the same thing. I want to work through them all. I think that's a great goal.
Cool. Well, you can totally keep up with me because I think you're one book behind. So you just got to fill in one more while I'm doing something else. I do something that you've already read.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm starting class in September, so then I'll have a class list to read. But I'll do my best.
Well, final thoughts.
So, yeah, I would say that I'm still really interested in the differences between Asian science fiction and Western science fiction. And those cultural differences I do find really fascinating. I just like the genre. So I read... James Clavell's Shogun when I was a teenager, and I just always I've just always really been into it ever since. So
this book was my dad's back of the toilet book.
Oh yeah. So, you saw that book in every house in the 1980s. Yep. I swear it was everywhere. And it's a long one, but oh man, I loved it so much.
Me too. I actually just recently bought it because it was cheap for Nook and Kindle.
Okay.
So I picked it up because it was my dad's favorite. At some point, I'm going to go back and read it again.
Me too. Yeah, it's on that list of rereads. So my love of dipping my toes into Asian cultures is still alive and well. No, it was good. It was a really good experience.
Well, another good experience was talking to you about this book.
Thanks.
I thought you were tremendous. So thank you so much for joining me.
Good.
So before we actually sign off, where can people get a hold of you?
Yeah. So it's easiest to find me on Twitter. I'm at Carrie Lynnland. So it's CarrieLynnland. And cool. I'm on there tweeting about either podcasts I'm on or science and tech news is often what I'm tweeting about as well. So yeah.
Cool. Well, I will make sure to drop a link into the show notes for that, and I'll tag you when the episode comes out as well, so people can follow you.
That'd be great.
Yeah, and down the line, look at the list again, and when I start running out of people to come on.
Well, I would love to come back if you think of me, because this is super fun. So
awesome. Well, I want to thank you again for coming on and just for being one of the early people to reach out on Twitter. I really appreciate that. It's always great when you're first starting out a podcast to find out that there's a real actual person that you've never met in real life who's actually listening.
Yeah.
So very grateful for that and for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. Well, we'll talk again another time.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Carrie Lynn. I thought she was fantastic. And I hope that you will go ahead and check out her social media links and other podcasting endeavors and show her some support there as well. I'll put all those links in the show notes. In the meantime, of course, if you are enjoying what I'm doing here, then I would invite you to go and leave us a review in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you're finding us. And of course, connect with us on social media. Just search for Hugo's Podcast. If you want to get a hold of me, you can do that on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast or through email, feedback@hugospodcast.com. If you have an idea for a guest that I should have on, then that'd be great. Or if you want to volunteer as guest, you can go ahead and email me there. And I think that'll about do it for this episode. So thank you again, of course, for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye.